On April 12, 1987, Michael Morton sat down to write a letter. "Your Honor," he began, "I'm sure you remember me. I was convicted of murder in your court in February of this year." He wrote each word carefully, sitting cross-legged on the top bunk in his cell at the Wynn Prison Unit in Huntsville. "I have been told that you are to decide if I am ever to see my son Eric again. I haven't seen him since the morning that I was convicted. I miss him terribly, and I know that he has been asking about me." Referring to the declarations of innocence he had made during his trial, he continued, "I must reiterate my innocence. I did not kill my wife. You cannot imagine what it is like to lose your wife the way I did, then to be falsely accused and convicted of this terrible crime. First my wife, and now possibly my son. Sooner or later, the truth will come out. The killer will be caught, and this nightmare will be over. I pray that the sheriff's office keeps an open mind. It is no sin to admit a mistake. No one is perfect in the performance of their job. I don't know what else to say, except I swear to God that I did not kill my wife. Please don't take my son from me, too." His windowless concrete cell, which he shared with another inmate, measured 5 by 9 feet. If he extended his arms, he could touch the walls on either side of him. A small metal locker that was bolted to the wall contained one of the few remnants he still possessed from his previous life. A photograph of Eric when he was 3 years old, taken shortly before the murder. The boy was standing in the backyard of their house in Austin, playing with a windsock, grabbing the streamers that fluttered behind it in the breeze. There was a picture, too, of his late wife, Christine, a candid shot Michael had taken of her years earlier, with her hair pinned up, still wet from a bath. She was looking away from the camera, but she was smiling slightly, her fingers pressed against her mouth. The crime scene photos were still fresh in Michael's mind, but if he focused on the snapshot, the horror of those images abated. Christine with damp hair, smiling. This was how he wanted to remember her. The last time he had seen her was on the morning of August 13, 1986, the day after his 32nd birthday. He had glanced at her as she lay in bed, asleep, before he left for work around 5:30. He returned home that afternoon to find the house cordoned off with yellow crime scene tape. 6 weeks later, he was arrested for her murder. He had no criminal record, no history of violence, and no obvious motive. But the Williamson County Sheriff's Office, failing to pursue other leads, had zeroed in on him from the start. Although no physical evidence tied him to the crime, he was charged with first-degree murder. Prosecutors argued that he had become so enraged with Christine for not wanting to have sex with him on the night of his birthday that he had bludgeoned her to death. When the guilty verdict was read, Michael's legs buckled beneath him. District Attorney Ken Anderson told reporters afterward, "Life in prison is a lot better than he deserves." The conviction had triggered a bitter custody battle between Christine's family, who, like many people in Michael's life, came to believe that he was guilty, and Michael's parents. The question of who would be awarded custody of Eric was to be resolved by State District Judge William Lott, who had also presided over Michael's trial. If Christine's family won custody, Michael was justifiably concerned that he would never see his son again. 2 weeks after sending his first entreaty to Lott, Michael penned another letter. "My son has lost his mother," he wrote. Psychological good can come from seeing his one surviving parent. Ultimately, custody of the boy was awarded to Christine's younger sister, Mary Lee Kirkpatrick. But at the recommendation of a child psychiatrist who felt that Eric should know his father, Lott agreed to allow 2 supervised visits a year. Mary Lee drove Eric to Huntsville every 6 months to see his father. He was 4 when the visits began.